dark matter halos that have formed. And with a view to them being detectable with glass or something like it, because there's so many of them, they can be so close to us. Okay, and so skip into my motivation for studying this. I spent my PhD studying MOND most of the time, and it was discussed in Jim Peebles' talk yesterday that MOND does a very good job of doing galactic dynamics, fitting rotation curves, the Tully-Fisher relation. It also does a really good job of fitting the dwarf galaxies of the Milky Way. People might want to check that out. And now people are starting to look at the CMB and clusters, and there are predictions. And the key thing is that you need dark matter in MOND at the cluster scale, at cosmological scale. There's no doubt about that. And no, it can't be Jupiter's, as you rightly say. It has to be something like a sterile neutrino. And so the point is that this is a hot dark matter candidate, and so it has a free streaming scale that's like 50 kiloparsecs or something within a Milky Way type galaxy. So there's no substructure. So this is the key. If we can find substructure in the Milky Way, then we can go some way towards getting people to give up on MOND. Although that might be a little bit more difficult than that. Another point I'd like to say that is, even if the LHA does find evidence for WIMPs, it won't tell us that the existing galaxies. We really have to do what Anne said and get it in the three-pronged approach. So this had a great introduction so far to the formation of microhalos. And so this was all laid out by Stefan and Anne and people like that. And then Jurgis managed to run these multi-mass scale simulations and actually form these Earth mass microhalos. And he's shown that there's something like 10 to the 15 of these in the Milky Way. That's an enormous, enormous number. But since they just weigh 10 to the minus 6 solar masses, they're very susceptible to being destroyed by interactions with stars all throughout the disk of the Milky Way. And that was shown, I think, first of all, by my supervisor, Hongcheng Zhao, in a paper we had with James and Joe Silk. But the key thing is that these microhalos, because they're so close to us, if we could observe them, there might be a chance that we could actually see their proper motion. Other people like myself and Anne and Ben Morsch and Tobias studied the interactions with the stars of the microhalos. And it's still a bit of an unknown thing, but what is for sure is that the survival of these microhalos is very dependent on their orbits. So here we have something like some sort of density contour of a Milky Way type galaxy. And here's a few orbits here, given by their velocity in the Z direction and their total velocity. And so you don't want an orbit that goes straight into the bulge, because it's going to pass a huge number of stars. It's going to get tidally destroyed. You don't want an orbit that crosses the disk many, many times. Again, it's going to be destroyed. You want something with a really, really sort of high angular momentum orbit that also takes it out way out into the outer halo and doesn't come any closer than the sun's position. Obviously, it needs to come to the sun's position so we can see it. It has to come close to the sun. And you want it to go way out of the plane and only cross the disk once per orbit. Okay. So what I did was I took these 10 to the 15 microhalos, and I put them in a typical NFW Milky Way dark matter halo, so something like from the Gnedden and Zhao paper. There was a few references to Milky Way NFWs, and they're all pretty much this 10 to the 12 solar masses, variable radius of 250 kiloparsec. And so within, if you do the math, within 10 parsecs of the sun, you've got about 20,000, 19,000 microhalos. Okay? And if you can take the NFW distribution function at the sun's position, then you can generate their orbital velocities. And you get something like this distribution. So this is the tangential component from the sun towards the center of the galaxy, and this is the velocity in the x direction. So that's directly towards the center of the Milky Way. And so you've got these, and you want the highest velocity ones, right? That's the ones we're interested in. That's the ones that should survive, might survive the tides of the stars. So you've got here just about 33 microhalos that have a tangential velocity that's above 300 kilometers per second. I come on to the survivability of that. Yeah, just a little bit. This next slide, I think. Yeah. And so we're very poor in St Andrews in Scotland. We don't have these multi-billion probably dollar supercomputers. So we can't run all 19,000. So we just have to be a bit selective of what we do. And so we took the 33, and so we need to follow these orbits back in time, really, in some sort of Milky Way potential, and get some distribution of the stars. And we'll come on to that in a minute. And I just have to point out a couple of sort of timescales involved. The crossing time of a star across a Milky, a microhalo is about 100 years or something. The dynamical time inside the microhalo is about 10 mega years. Okay? And the orbital period of these of the microhalos around the galaxy is about 500 to mega years, so about 3 giga years. And so this isn't an option to actually have stars going across the microhalo. We need some sort of analytical input to generalize that. So what we did, yes, is next slide, is we used what's called the impulse approximation of Spitzer. It's in Binion Tremain. And so basically, you have a kick to the velocity distribution of the particles inside the microhalo. So that's the change in velocity, and it's proportional to the mass of the star that's going past, the impact parameter of the star and the center of the microhalo, and the relative velocity between the star and the microhalo is also important. And so we did the real thing, and we popped some stars past the microhalo in this 100-year time scale, and then we compared that with what we analytically expect from the impulse approximation here for three different masses of stars, so one solar mass, 0.3, 0.1, and for different impact parameters. And the agreement's pretty good, so we think it's okay to pop it in. There's plenty of other unknowns that are there. That can cloud it. Okay, so the next step was the clever part, I think, was having realistic simulations of these microhalo orbits in a galactic potential. So we took the Bevanson model by Annie Robin, and so that gives the stars in the galaxy has a IMF for the different masses of the stars. And it, you know, has multiple components, has the thin disk, the thick disk, the bulge, and the stellar halo, and it gives you the masses of the stars, so the kind of IMF of the different stars in these different radii inside the Milky Way. So every time step you're going through this microhalo is going through some length, which is the product of its relative velocity with the stars and the time step. And you have some cutoff radius where it doesn't matter how massive your star is, it's not going to perturb the microhalo. And then you can come up with the total kind of number of total mass that it's passing through by integrating the density over the volume. And then so you just randomly choose star masses from the IMF for each component. And you keep doing that until you come to the total mass. Okay, so you generate a bunch of stars, a one solar mass, a half solar mass, and finally you get to the total mass, and you stop. And so you analytically impose these impulses on the microhalo particles every time step. And so it turns out what I was saying before about the importance of the orbital distribution of the microhalos around the galaxy. There's a strong relationship between the average stellar density that this microhalo goes past, so the kind of column that it's going through as it goes around its orbit, And you can see here that the kind of lifetime of these microhalos probably get completely destroyed. So all the particles become unbound, at least to our, as well as we can resolve that. And so you see this is the average stellar density and solar masses per parsec cubed. And if you get to something like 10 to the minus 3 solar masses per parsec cubed, you've got a chance of it surviving for, you know, we only ran the simulations for 7 gigayears, but you can presume that there wasn't too many stars before that.
So can I ask you something? So is it the way it's supposed that every star heats up the, so you just add the temperature, increase the temperature until it passes very young temperature, until it's unbound, basically?
So these particles leave and then...
Particles leave or you heat the whole system?
Yeah, the individual particles heat up and then they can leave. And you don't follow them anymore.
But the tidal field can also heat the whole mini halo.
Both happen. Okay, so this is a bunch of runs that we did for the 33 microhalos. And you can see each kind of dip you see here is an interaction with a star. So it's kicking out some particles, and they're leaving. And you see the black lines, all of these microhalos are being destroyed. But there is some hope for a few of them surviving, you know, about a Hubble time, with like more than 50% of the particles still intact. And so there is some sort of hope for the 19,000 microhalos, that most of them are being destroyed and being put into streams like Anne said, but there's a few of them within 10 parsecs that might survive over the Hubble time. And so I don't know at the moment what this means for glass, but so you can see the talks that have come before, but if you just put some numbers into it, the size of the microhalo is about 1/100th of a parsec, and so at 10 parsecs, that's an angle of about 3 arc minutes. And so it would take 50 years for, so the proper motion that has, it would take 50 years for it to move outside the overlap that it has at the moment. So it has some physical size. To move completely outside that would be 50 years. That's if you see everything, you see all the gamma rays out to 1/100th of a parsec. If you only see 10% of that, then the size of it's only 21 arc seconds, and it will only take 5 years to move. And it doesn't have to move the whole distance across to be visible. Okay. So that's really the end of the talk, except future work is to try and look at the slightly higher mass microhalos that might be a little bit more robust to encounters with stars. And so they might survive in bigger abundances. But then, of course, because there's not 10 to the 15 of them, they might be slightly further away and more difficult to detect.
Okay, thanks. Other questions?
I've seen you have used a presentation for a middle of two for this.
Sure, yeah, we should try something a bit higher.
Well, the concentration power usually decreases as you expect from that steepness, right? So it's a very small scale, so we're the power spectrum is very steep, tends to be, they'll tend to be as well bound as, it tends to be more triaxial, less concentrated. So it might be more prone to destruction.
Yeah.
They form very early, right?
Yeah. That's the point. You can't just take one of these things and dump it into the black potential. They have to, I mean, when they're the first object, right, the mergers are all going to be similar mass mergers. Right? That's the first step they have to survive, similar mass mergers.
But he's talking about the ones, you know, that are at 10 to the minus 6 solar masses, right?
Yeah.
Not the ones that have been swallowed by other more massive objects, right? You know, it's the surviving ones he's talking about.
Yeah, but my point is the profile that you take is sort of the profile from ones that just formed, right? In the first simulation, and then they give a density profile.
Yeah.
But especially for the abundance, right? I don't know how good the extrapolation back from 10 to the 6 solar masses is to 10 to the minus 6 of the subhalo mass function. I mean, that's what I'm looking at.
But you have actual simulations of 10 to the minus 6 solar mass.
But they're very tricky. Right? The problem is with the spectral index being that steep, your actual simulation can go wrong very, very quickly.
So they don't continue it all the way to zero, of course. But
No, but the issue is So your small, like a very steep spectral index, your small scale is nonlinear, your larger scale is basically nonlinear as well, mm-hmm. and stuff goes, like the estimate of nonlinearity is not one anymore, right? If you're, if dead, let's say the variance is one, steep indices, you're well past nonlinear, so it's tough to judge how good these things are.
Yeah, people always used to say that, and then, well, I mean, I don't know, maybe not the best place person to comment on this, but my impression was actually the simulations were surprisingly well organized and together on things at high redshift, because although it's true that in a statistical sense, the spectral index is flat and you're close to everything collapsing at the same time and so on, that's never true locally. It's always the case locally that you know exactly who's going to collapse first, and there's a well-organized hierarchy. The big peaks collapse first, the small peaks collapse later, and it's all totally hierarchical, and you don't have to worry about it. So if you did some, if you asked what's the mass of things collapsing in redshift, that's totally chaotic. But if you ask what's the sequence with which things collapse, it actually looks exactly like low redshift, just on a whole range of different mass scales from patch to patch in the universe.
Well, so I would say the sequence is still off order, right? But the issue is, so if you want to look at nice, like if you want to figure out star formation, so this little patch is going to collapse first, but the next little patch is going to collapse very soon afterwards. So the first little patch gets pushed to
that's what I'm saying. That doesn't actually happen, because locally, you always have a big, big difference between when things collapse or how much they collapse by, because they're big peaks and small peaks.
Yeah,
well, that was my impression, but I don't know.
Yeah, but you're both sort of right. It's still kind of hierarchical at very small mass scales, but much less so, right? The time difference between when the small fraternities form until when the bigger things form, that's much smaller. It's still hierarchical. The small stuff in the same region forms first, but you end up having less contrast.
Yeah.
That's what
okay, so
it's just
so the contrast.
The first step they have to survive, because these are first falling into like solar mass systems, and later on they're going to fall into the Milky Way.
It's all about just the compression and the sort of relative formation time, right? I mean, the sequence is there, it's just when you form very quickly after you.
I guess I'm not sure how much that compression is locally. So I mean, I don't know, maybe it's the case that locally there's still a big compression. But.
The other questions? One other question. So you said, I think that we had like, you said a halo is disrupted, then it's lost like 80 or 90% of its mass or so.
Yeah.
Is it lost uniformly, or is it more, I mean, it's probably easier to strip matter up from the outer edges. So then the core must remain dense. And so I mean, if you strip 80% of the mass, it's not really affecting the mass that's actually annihilating and producing luminosity.
Yeah.
I don't know,
80% that are still nearby, and even if it's starting to pile up, it's like high enough that it could kind of symbol, I guess
my question is it 80% of the mass that gets lost, or is it the whole thing evaporated?
So my accuracy is all getting
smaller.
But you guys might want to be
are there other questions? Okay, so let's thank Gary again.